Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome back. This is Dr. Cassandra Quabe, and you're listening to Foodie from Ecology, the science podcast for the food curious. Today, we're going to talk about food, and I'm talking food from all over the world. What types of foods do we eat? Do different cultures eat different foods? I think we all know that they do, but what does that actually mean from a nutritional perspective? So our guest today is Dr. Anna Herforth. She leads initiatives to improve global food measurement. She's currently a senior research associate in the Department of Global Health and Population at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And she's also a visiting senior researcher at Wageningen University and Research. Dr. Herforth is the principal investigator of the Global Diet Quality Project, the first ever global survey of what people eat. Dr. Herforth has over a decade of consulting experience with international institutions, including CGIAR agencies, the World Bank, and the United Nations. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Anna. It's great to see you.
Thanks, Cassandra. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, I was really impressed with this info in your bio that you're leading the first ever global survey of what people eat. So how do you even start to do something like that? How do you capture this amount of data from people all around the world?
It's a great question. So you would think that it wouldn't be that hard. It's 2024. Do we not already know what people eat around the world? It's really pretty basic information. And the fact is, there really has never been a global survey of what people eat before. And when I talk about that, people, they're usually very surprised, because you would think, you know, it's very obvious information. We sort of know different kind of cultural eating patterns and different kinds of diets that keep us healthier, put us at risk of chronic diseases. But, you know, when I was studying in graduate school, I was studying international nutrition at Cornell University and learning about all of the different indicators that we have that are tracked globally on factors that affect nutrition outcomes, like whether children are stunted or underweight. And there were all these different facets that can lead to that outcome. But I kept sort of flipping through the pages looking for, what about what people eat? What about their diet? And I couldn't ever find it. And I thought I was missing something. And the fact is, it just wasn't there. There were no indicators of diet around the world. And so that kind of set the tone for what I felt like I wanted to do to fill that gap. And it's been a process to try to find a mechanism, a way that you could feasibly go and ask people around the world what they eat and get useful information out of that. And so the bottom line is, currently how the survey works is that I'm collaborating with the Gallup World Poll. And the Gallup World Poll has a multi-topic survey that they run every year on nationally representative samples around the world in every country. And we work together to create a module on diet quality. And so it's a 5-minute module that has now been asked in countries around the world in the Gallup World Poll.
So when you talk about diet quality, I mean, what are the types of questions that people are being asked? Or is it just like a list of typical foods they eat? Or like, what does that include?
Yes. So basically, that's exactly right. And they're very targeted. The types of foods we ask about are targeted to the type of information that will say something about diet quality, either in a sense of what's keeping people healthy or what's putting their health at risk. And so one of the central innovations that happened about a decade ago in the field of nutrition was this validation of a food group level indicator that corresponded to nutrient intake. So nutrient intake is something that's really hard to measure. It takes a lot of expertise and time to ask people very in detail what they ate so you can calculate the nutrients that they consumed. And so that just wasn't feasible and it wasn't happening. So instead, there was this idea to use food groups as a proxy for nutrient intake, because we know that people who eat more diverse diets tend to be healthier, tend to have better nutritional status. So that observation, that insight, led to this testing process that a number of scientists did for about a decade to come up with an indicator of minimum dietary diversity that corresponded to nutrient intake. And so that was a central innovation that we then built upon to use food groups to further understand different aspects of diet beyond nutrients. So, for example, the diversity of sweet food and beverages that a person has consumed in the previous day actually says something about their quantitative sugar intake. And so that's how the survey works. We ask them about food groups, but instead of asking people like, did you eat any dark green leafy vegetables? I would instead ask you, did you eat kale, chard, amaranth, or nightshade, as an example? You know, and those lists of foods are tailored to every single country for what are the most common foods in the country in each food group.
Yeah, because certainly there are vegetables that are incredibly popular, I don't know, in Asia that we never see in the U.S. So those questions would be very, yeah, that's great. They're tailored in that way. Cool.
Yes, and that process of tailoring the questions was so much fun.
Yeah.
So I have a team of people who we work together, and for the last several years, we have interviewed, it's almost 1,000 people, 958 people so far. Around the world, each person we have interviewed, we've talked to them for about an hour and a half to ask them in the country where they live and work, what are the most common foods in each of these food groups so that we can build a question around those foods. And then we keep going with more people in the country until we hit saturation where we're not getting new information. And we have a very solid list of foods that sort of everyone we talk to agrees like that is, those are the most common foods in that food group in this country. And so then from that list for each food group, we've built a questionnaire for the country with a, you know, participatory collaborative input from this network of food experts around the world. And people love talking about food, as you know. So every time we would talk with, you know, sometimes it would be hard to get people on the phone or on Skype, you know, the people are busy and you know, they would donate their time to talk about this, like, what are the foods you eat? Like, not you personally, but in the country. And then we'd get going and people would just not want to stop talking because it's so fun to, you know, say, oh, you can make this dish for that. And people used to grow this and now it's not so common anymore. Or people in the dry region grow this, or, you know, all these different nuances of the foods that are most common in each country.
That's awesome. Well, and I have a super basic question, so forgive me for my ignorance here, but I'm wondering when you talk about food groups, what does that actually mean? Are we talking about like the food pyramid with carbohydrates and greens? Like what do you mean by food groups?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's exactly, that question is exactly why we ask about specific foods to the respondent, because everybody has a different idea of what a food group is. And in the initial stages of testing questions, we first started out by asking things like, did you eat kale, chard, amaranth, or other dark green leaves? As an example, or we would do like, did you eat cookies, cakes, or other sweet foods? And what we found is that those questions, you might think they would work well, but they did not, because people would have different ideas about what we meant by other dark green leaves. So if I said other dark green leaves, they might say, yes, I had cabbage. That's logical. That's reasonable. But when I mentioned the group that had validated this food group approach to understanding nutrient intake, they sort of defined specific food groups that corresponded to specific nutrients. And in the case of dark green leafy vegetables, those vegetables corresponded to vitamin A, iron, you know, primarily, and some other nutrients that are really rich in dark green leaves, but not so rich in lighter green leaves like cabbage. And so cabbage doesn't belong in that category. From our perspective as the scientists who designed it, it totally could belong in that category for somebody else, you know, but we didn't leave those questions open-ended because people would respond based on their own categorization of what a food group is. As for sweet foods as well, we would ask, did you eat, you know, cookies, cakes, or other sweet foods? We found that in some contexts, people would say, yes, I had fruit. It's a sweet food. You know, it doesn't, but that's not what we wanted in that food group. So what I mean when I say food groups is a set of food groups that has been defined for some reason that has to do with basically their nutrient content, whether it's macronutrients like carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, or micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, or potentially other things like level of processing that says something about food system changes and, you know, processed foods in the food supply. So like we have an instant noodles category. And that the reason for that as a food group is that it's an indicator of how food systems are transitioning into, you know, more packaged processed foods. And so we have identified 29 food groups that the reason there's 29 is because when we did validation studies of the correspondence to those specific food groups, to specific kinds of content of food, fiber, nutrients, you know, packaging, that was what we needed to understand. We didn't need 30. We didn't need 27. We just needed 29 because that's what corresponded to the outcomes we're trying to measure for diet quality.
Nice. No, I really like this approach because you're able to, like you said, get a better nutritional perspective on what's happening with high processed foods, sweet foods versus more complex, perhaps nutrient rich dishes. Well, I'm hearing from you too that diversity really matters when it comes to diet based on these studies. And I know there's an upcoming event with the Periodic Table of Food Initiative. It is called the Celebrating Food Diversity, Scientific Advances, and Community Innovation Summit that is coming up soon, both online and in person at New York Botanical Garden, where you're going to be launching the World Food Map. What's the World Food Map? That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, the World Food Map is a celebration of food diversity. So fits very well with the theme of the event, which is many other things as well, in which we can talk about further some of those as well. But the World Food Map organically came out of the Global Diet Quality Project. So the process that I just described of interviewing people around the world to identify the most common foods in each food group in each country had a specific purpose, which was to generate valid questionnaires so that we could put them in the Gallup World Poll so that we could get indicators of diet quality. But in so doing, we realized that we happened to be doing the first ever systematic cataloging of the most common foods in every country. And so with that realization that this was something new and something that a lot of people had given a lot of time to come up with, we decided that it would be a really good idea to make an atlas of those foods and not just leave them in lists of questionnaires, which has its own utility, but to create an interactive world food map where you could visit each country and find the most common foods there and find photos of those foods and their botanical classification, other things about maybe their crop center of origin, if they're crops. And relatedly, so the event that you mentioned is put on by the Periodic Table of Food Initiative and partners. And that's an initiative that seeks to understand the composition of food beyond nutrients and into plant secondary compounds, phytochemicals, and other types of components of food that have health impacts, but that haven't been well characterized, certainly not in the field of nutrition, but even in general, there's so much to learn about chemistry of food and the content of food. So we're partnering, the World Food Map is partnering with PTFI, the Periodic Table of Food Initiative, to merge that information so that not only can you find the most common foods in each country, you can also learn about their composition that's related to health. So we'll be integrating that information as the PTFI starts to generate it.
That's amazing. Oh, that's really exciting to be able to get this global. It's almost like, you know, Disney World Epcot view of like all these things together with multiple dimensions. That's really exciting. When you think about predominant foods in different places, I was just running through my mind, like, what would it pop up, you know, with for America? Is it like French fries or in cheeseburgers? Like what are some examples of some of the more common foods that have emerged in different parts of the world? Do you have any interesting ones you can share?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple layers to that answer because so the way that we've done the interviews that generated this data that is going on to the World Food Map is that we ask about the most common foods in each food group, and there's 29 food groups. So for each country, you'll get the most common items per food group, right? So maybe in the United States, for dark green leafy vegetables, I can't remember off the top of my head, but we might have spinach and mustard greens and chard as maybe, you know, the top ones. And then in Kenya, we might have kale called sukumawiki. And that's another thing we learned from people is how to say the foods so that people recognize the word. And, you know, amaranth and nightshade and African spider plant, right? So we would have those. But the prevalence of consumption is the other layer, because that's going to be different. So even though we'll have the most common foods in each category, you know, in East Africa, the prevalence of consuming that kind of food is quite a bit higher than in the United States. So we can compare, you know, the level of eating dark green leafy vegetables and the level of eating French fries and other deep fried foods, which is another category, is deep fried foods. So we will see clearly from the Global Diet Quality Project data from the Gallup World Poll that even though we have common food groups in each category, some categories are much more prevalent. And you do definitely see that in the American diet. We have, you know, we actually have a lot of diet data in the US, which is not the case for almost every country in Africa and many in Asia. But, you know, we do have high prevalence of consumption of sweet beverages, fast foods, deep fried foods, red meat, whereas you will see very different patterns of those food groups in other countries. So it's kind of the combination of the two levels, like the most common foods, but then the difference in prevalence in how much of each type of food is consumed.
That's great. Well, and as you're speaking about this, I'm also thinking of all the different ways one could use a data set like this. I mean, it'll be an incredible data set from a nutrition perspective, but I'm imagining that, you know, epidemiologists will be very interested in this as well, to look at morbidity, mortality within regions with these very different diets. Is that part of your long-term plan also, to kind of look at how this ties into health outcomes in these regions? Or are you partnering with folks that are doing that?
That's absolutely the type of application that we hope to enable with this data. You know, when we started chatting today about kind of the diet data gap and how incredible it is that we haven't had this level of information just on what people eat and basic diet patterns that's current and comparable across countries, that has really constrained the type of research that can be done in nutrition and epidemiology. So now, you know, with having this data across countries, we do hope that it will open up the possibility for all kinds of research. And we ourselves as a research team, you know, I'm at Harvard, we have partners at GAIN, the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, as well as Gallup, as well as Wageningen University. But we ourselves don't have to do everything. We're making the data open access so that it can just generate all kinds of insights from different research teams around the world, exactly like you suggested, in nutrition epidemiology and looking at correlations between how diets are, but then hopefully being able to track trends over time and how they're changing and how that relates to changes in health outcomes and nutrition as well.
Amazing. No, I think that's fantastic that the data will be open access, because there's so many uses for this, I'm sure. So I want to talk a little bit more about your collaboration with the PTFI, or the Periodic Table of Food Initiative. I think it's really exciting what they're doing with really trying to unveil the whole, like, the molecular diversity behind our foods, like beyond the classic nutrient items of vitamins and whatnot, but also these other secondary metabolites, which we know have impact on our health. And so, yeah, can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that broader context of what the PTFI is aiming for?
Yeah, it's super exciting. And my background is actually in ethnobotany and plant science. And so this is near and dear to my heart of, you know, the types of analyses that are going to be done by PTFI. I'll give you an example to sort of illustrate what I hope, you know, will come out of the initiative. When I was doing my dissertation work in East Africa, which is why I keep talking about green vegetables in East Africa, that's actually what I studied. But part of my research was looking at the variation in varieties, because people would grow many different varieties of the same species. Sometimes actually they were a different species. Sometimes it was of the same genus, like amaranth, you know, has the same genus in several species. So people would grow different varieties for different reasons. that had to do with taste, seasonality, marketability, pest resistance, all kinds of reasons. And many times they would grow multiple varieties at the same time to satisfy many different, you know, desires for the crop. And so, you know, usually when you, if you go to a food composition table, say you looked up amaranth and you would see one value, one line, and yet there's so much diversity within that genus of what amaranth is. And so as part of my research, collaborating with the World Vegetable Center at the time, did an analysis of the chemical composition, both nutrients and some broad phytochemical categories, you know, types of antioxidants and polyphenols, and found that the different varieties of amaranth were as different from each other as different vegetables are from each other entirely.
Incredible.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
And think about Brassica oleraceae.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. Tell the audience about this, because it always just, I have a class and I bring out different varieties of this and say, what do these have in common? And it always takes a while for them to get to it. Oh, it's actually, you know, tell us about it.
Nice. I love that. Yeah. You do that for your class.
Yeah.
So broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, same species. So
it's the same, and what species else? I mean, and how different flavor, yeah. You know, size, shape. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the nutrient composition, the chemical composition of those different varieties is obviously very different. And so part of what PTFI is doing is like, let's not have one nutrient composition for amaranth, right? Let's have some more information about varietal characteristics, how it was grown, you know, whether plants have been grown in a drier condition or a wetter condition, it may have an impact on their composition as well. So to unpack some of that variation that comes from the variation in the plants themselves, and, you know, to then tying that back into the world food map to be able to display, you know, some of these ranges of, you know, if you're looking at different types of the same species, whether it's a brassica or whether it's a kind of fruit, and, you know, mangoes, tons of different varieties of mangoes, bananas, you know, so to see these levels of variation and ultimately, like, far in the future down the line, to maybe be able to have more geographic specificity on, like, maybe you could in the future, you know, this is far to come, but enter in, like, how was something grown? Where was it grown? What was the variety? And then how does that correspond to what is probably in the food?
Nice. No, that's amazing. And it really speaks, like you said, to diversity and for the listeners, just to remember that we have so many varieties of our kind of core crops, like brassica or your tomatoes, and all the different shapes and colors. All those colors and flavor differences come down to chemistry. They have very different chemical profiles. And, you know, the chemistry of our food affects our health. And so that's why it's important for us to understand it. That's really great. Well, I know that, you know, your work is really, you know, brings in this additional appreciation for crop diversity, which I think is largely missed in a lot of the older, you know, nutritional literature. What are the things that drive you to do this kind of work? What are the kind of things that really get you excited about what you're doing?
You just said it, diversity. I was so sort of, I had this culture shock when I moved from the field of ethnobotany into the field of nutrition, because in ethnobotany, there's like this huge appreciation for diversity and studying diversity, cultural diversity that's linked with biological diversity. And then in nutrition, you know, encountering these food composition tables that just have like one value for a tomato, it always struck me as bizarre to try as a nutritionist to accurately summarize what people actually eat and the nutrients they consume when we have such limited data on what's actually there. You know, if we assign a set of nutrients to a tomato, it's a point estimate of a very broad range of error, I would say. And so to try to specify exactly how much of any particular nutrient a person consumed is virtually impossible without having done chemical analysis of exactly the exact items they actually ate. And then you have, you know, all kinds of, that's like also impossible because of the biases of interfering with what people eat. So that, you know, that appreciation for diversity as really the thing that protects us and nourishes us. We can try to be specific on what, you know, what exact levels of nutrients we need. But with all that we don't know about all the details of what's in food, ultimately the answer of how to eat a healthy, nutritious diet is diversity. And diversity will provide nutrients. It'll provide health protective phytochemicals. It will provide, you know, other components like fiber, the food structure that has an impact on the gut health, microbiome. And it will also, diversity will also protect against potential toxins that may be natural toxins, that may be added toxins such as pesticides. So, you know, ultimately, there's so much we don't know about food that consuming diversity is going to be the best protection for healthfulness and avoidance of disease. And it's something that I think we really need globally as a form of respect and appreciation for not only what is offered by the earth, also the interaction with human ingenuity that has been there, you know, that it's just a fundamental human nature of observing plants, animals, their interactions, their effects on health, and the incredible knowledge that different cultures have developed about how to prepare foods, how to not only make them delicious, but also nutritious, and to avail ourselves of what is there and what is offered. And so, you know, coming into, again, like entering the field of nutrition and trying to understand what's the data on food, what's the data on what people eat, and really seeing that the only indicators that were there as of, you know, 10 years ago, the only indicators on food were essentially availability of calories. And that is so far from what we need to know about food for, you know, measuring food globally, for measuring what impacts our health, that it just, that gap between like an indicator of calorie availability and all of diversity that sustains human and planetary health is what drives me. It's trying to close that gap and bring in measures of diversity for health that will motivate investments and motivate action towards crop diversification and an underlying appreciation for biocultural diversity that is so important for, you know, sustaining everyone's health and nutrition and also planetary health.
Well, that's great. Well, and like you said, like crop diversification is also important for ensuring that we have food during a time of drought or during some other, you know, pathogen attack on our crops. Like whenever we rely on a very narrow genetic window, we are really setting ourselves up for disaster. So that leads me to my next question. What keeps you up at night?
Besides doing the work itself.
Besides grant writing and all of that stuff. But I mean, are there challenges? Are there things that you're noting? You're talking about planetary and human health and nutrition. Are there trends that you see happening that concern you? I guess that's the bigger question. Maybe you sleep at night, but like, it's like, what are the most pressing challenges that you think we need to tackle at this point in time?
I feel like it's, in a word, disconnection from our food and where it comes from. And a lot of that disconnection is furthered by the corporatization of food and the profit orientation that has been taken in increasingly in food systems, where in many places there's kind of a holdover colonial mindset where traditional foods were perhaps denigrated and not respected in sometimes overtly towards consumption of more European or Westernized foods. And there's still kind of that holdover in a lot of places due to the colonial legacy of many places in the world, especially in the global South. And now there's almost like a sort of neo-colonialism of that's not like a national power, but it's more like a corporate power, which overtly tries to influence people to consume foods that are not in their best interest for health, but really they're in company's best interest.
Yeah, the instant noodles that are overtaking yes. many regions, these kind of shelf-stable, but obviously not, you know, nutritious.
yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for profit, there's like a race to the bottom in terms of how cheaply can you make something and what profit margin can you get to sell sort of the worst quality food nutritionally based on very few ingredients and a lot of additives to be able to profit. Now, not all processing is bad, right? Processing is very important. Processing and also marketing can be an absolutely force for, you know, helping people to access food, to preserve food so that there's less food waste, so that there's more access. You know, I have to say personally, if I didn't have frozen vegetables and canned beans and, you know, processed forms of starchy staples, I would not eat very well. It makes it much more convenient for me to have, you know, this level of processing in the food supply. But then there's sort of an extent of that gets overdone and heavily marketed. And I think that is the biggest concern of sort of overt displacement of what is diverse and health promoting and preserving cultural diversity that's like well connected to a land and a place with something that is disconnected.
That's so well said. It's a complex systems issue. And I think the main underlying lesson is that diversity is key for our diets. Having less highly processed foods is better for us. We know that from health studies, but there's so much we still don't know about the nutritional intakes across the globe. So I'm really excited about the work that you're doing. This survey, I think, will really open the door to, you know, many additional studies that can be done on this topic of understanding this connection between food and health and our planet. So kudos on doing some amazing work. And I'm really looking forward to the upcoming PTFI symposium as well in April. And for all of our listeners, I will make sure to include the link to that, to the events. You can sign up and tune in remotely, or if you're in the New York area, you can register and attend in person, I believe, as well. Thanks so much, Anna, for coming on the show. It was really great to talk with you.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to talk with you too.
Great. You've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded for you today on a Squadcast. I want to give a big shout out of thanks to our producers, to Rob Cohen and Christine Roth, for putting on a great show for you each and every week. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in each and every week. This particular episode was brought to us by the Periodic Table of Food Initiative. And as always, we're very grateful for their support. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you all stay healthy out there, and we'll see you next time. This Foodie Pharmacology podcast is part of a special series co-designed with the Periodic Table of Food Initiative, also known as the PTFI. The views and opinions in this podcast are those of the presenters and represent the synthesis of science. The PTFI is a program of RF Catalytic Capital, managed by a collaborative team at the American Heart Association and the Alliance of Bioversity, CIAT, that seeks to advance our fundamental understanding of food composition by providing tools, data, and training to scientists across the globe so they can better characterize the quality of the world's edible biodiversity. The PTFI's ultimate goal is to advance data-driven solutions in the food sector for the health of people and the planet. Funding for the PTFI is provided by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research, C-Rave Foundation, Fourfold Foundation, and Atria Health Collaborative.